Good morning, everyone. I want to welcome you back to the third installment of the 2018 Summer Colloquium, The Beloved Community, the Church's Call to Racial Justice. And I just want to begin with a note to all the fathers in the room. Happy Father's Day. Thank you. Thank you. To all the mothers who helped us get to be fathers, thank you. There's something that goes on there, I don't know. But also, it's a great day because Mexico won. ¡Que viva México! And just, spoiler alert. It's going to be a great day. Score 1-0. So, we're talking about church. The church of football. Just a reminder before we get started that in the back, Michelle and Mindy have cards and pens. So if you have a question for Floyd, we would encourage you to do that, whether you're writing that during the time or afterwards. So let me pray to open our time, and then I'll introduce our community voices to get us started. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this time to gather in your name, to hear your servants, Ruth and Vent and Floyd. Lord, as they speak to us and share of their own experience of being your faithful disciples, may you open our hearts, may you open our ears, may you open our minds to receive your word through your servants. Lord, continue to challenge us, to bless us and to equip us as a congregation as we consider what it means to be a church that is called to participate in racial justice. Help us, Lord, to hear with open hearts and to reflect upon what it means to think about those issues inside this church and in the world where you've called us. We pray this in your Son's name. Amen. For those of you who have been with us during the previous weeks, you know we started off our first session with a group panel. And last week, we had a community voice that spoke alongside Chandra. That was Leah Tang, for those of you who are here. And we want to continue that practice of having a community voice, of people who are sharing what it means for them to understand Christ's call upon them as they work out their own sense of identity as faithful disciples in a racialized world. So I want to welcome Ruth Traylor. She's going to start us off this morning. I'm not going to give you an introduction because she's an amazing woman who needs no introduction. But Ruth, come and join us. And I gave her the option to figure out how she wants to introduce Vent, so we'll be surprised. Thank you, dear.
Good morning, everyone. I'll just tell you, I'm feeling a little nervous. I have my water here. A little closer to the mic? Okay, is that good? Okay. Closer still, okay. Okay, I will tell you, when Vent was on the committee for the summer colloquium and when he told me that we were going to be on a panel, I sort of inwardly groaned, and maybe actually a little outwardly groaned as well, and thought, oh my gosh, but I thought, okay, there'll be like 4 to 6 people on this panel, I won't have to talk too much, and okay, we can do it. Well, you can imagine my surprise when just a few weeks ago, I opened up the church bulletin, and there in the insert is Community Voices, Ruth and Vent Traylor, and I'm going, oh my gosh. What in the world am I going to say? Now I have to really think about it. So I have always felt a little reticent about this because I'm not sure what I could add to the conversation about race and racial justice. And I think some of that reticence comes from what Vent has identified when he has said to me at times, Hayward, which is my maiden name, Hayward, the problem is you think you're white. And he's right. So as I started thinking about my life, it struck me how racism had a fundamental impact on my life, and I would not be standing here had it not been for that. And I'm going to try to get through this without crying, but we'll see. Some of you know my story, but for those of you who don't, I want to explain how these two threads came together. I was born in Korea, which in many ways has a racist society. The U.S. does not have a monopoly on racism. My mother was a young Korean woman, and my father was a white American GI. He got shipped back to the U.S. My mother thought he was going to return, but he did not. I may look Asian to you, but to Koreans at that time, I looked like someone who didn't fully belong. Through different circumstances, my mother came to work for three Southern Baptist missionary nurses as their housekeeper, and I lived with her on the mission hospital compound. I don't remember having Korean playmates. My friends and playmates were the white children of missionaries who worked at the hospital. I had no idea how isolated my life... Are you still having a hard time hearing? I had no idea how isolated my life was, but it was my normal. However, my mother was fully aware of the difficulties I would face if I grew into adulthood in this Korean culture. So with the assistance of the three nurses, she asked that Dr. Hayward, who had served a year at the hospital when I was a toddler, would adopt me. She knew him to be a good, kind man and would provide opportunities for me that she could not. And so it was that I came to the U.S. when I was almost six and became a member of the Hayward family, a well-grounded Christian family that taught biblical values. My new family was white. I had one sister, three brothers. I grew up in a small town in the central San Joaquin Valley. It had a population of 5,000 to 6,000 people, mostly made up of whites, Hispanics, and some Asians. The church I attended, with its 1,000-seat capacity, so you can imagine out of a town of 5,000 to 6,000 people, our church could seat 1,000, was all white. Our social circle was white. And when I went to the grocery store or to the library or wherever in town, people would say, "Oh, you're Dr. Hayward's daughter." I didn't really know the significance of that, except as time went on, I somehow understood that there was privilege associated with that. So this is the culture I was raised in, where I understood and appropriated the privileges of being white, even if racially I was not. I met Vent after I moved to San Francisco. I can tell you it had not been in my plan that I was going to marry an African American. I can tell you also that it was not part of my parents' plan as well. When we decided to get married, they tried their hardest to dissuade us. The reasons given were concerns for faith, religious beliefs, cultural differences. However, after we were married and they got to know Vent, they loved him. In fact, he became their favorite child-in-law. And of course, those of you who know Vent would go, "Duh, of course that's the case." But it was also my father who somewhat embarrassedly admitted that racism on his part was one of the reasons he had not wanted us to marry. He never thought of himself as a racist person, but when he took the time to examine himself, he realized there it was. All of us need that self-examination. A couple of months ago, I came across an article about the Olympians who medaled in the 200-meter race at the 68 Olympics in Mexico City. Those of you who were old enough at that time remember the iconic photo of Tommy Smith and John Carlos with their raised fists and their black gloves. Their heads were bowed as the American flag was being raised and the Star-Spangled Banner was being played. I was 15 at that time, and I remember seeing that, and that I just thought they were being disrespectful to their country and their flag. Never mind, well, the other aspect of that too was the raising of the black fist. It was like black power, and that somehow felt menacing as well. Never mind that there was the civil rights movement going on, and that they were standing up for human rights, not just black rights, but human rights, and they were protesting the oppression of their people. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? You fast forward to 2016, and we have Colin Kaepernick, who's kneeling during the NFL games. How many times have we heard he's unpatriotic? He's being disrespectful of our country, our flag, our military. And then we have a president who uses the bully pulpit to say and create greater dissension by saying things like this, and I quote, "Get that son of a bitch off the field right now." When in fact, what is being protested is police brutality, young black men dying too early, and saying that black lives matter. You know, we're supposed to learn from history, and we're supposed to learn from our mistakes. Yesterday, we celebrated the life of my dad, who passed away on February 22nd. He was a good and generous man. He also admitted his faults, and he did that when he admitted his racist thoughts. I think most of us are like my father in many ways. We don't think of ourselves as being racist, and we're surprised when it's pointed out to us. Or upon self-reflection, we come to understand that we are. I have a friend who lives in a primarily white community here in the Bay Area. She was going to be out of town for a week and knew a young Ethiopian woman who needed a place for her family who were coming to the U.S. for a visit. She and her husband generously offered their home, and before leaving, they went to all of their neighbors to let them know who would be staying and that there would be no need for concern, no need to call the police. This is a couple who was sensitive to the needs of a person and family of color who paid attention. It also brought them face to face with the reality that others live with on a daily basis. I'm curious as to how many of us may have been the neighbor that, had we not been told ahead of time, would have been suspicious, would have felt that we needed to intervene. I think it's hard because many of the attitudes or responses we have are like fossils that get embedded in layers of silt and sediment, and it's really hard to break it out. But that's the challenge, to be aware, to be ready to listen, to have open ears, and to change. Thank you.
She says she forgot to introduce me. Yeah. Yeah. Now, let's see here. In 1655, the first slaves were brought to America. They were taken to Florida, and they lived there, you know, in the Florida area. 65 years later, the colonists came and settled on the East Coast. Somewhere during the 1700s, the British decided that they were tired of being slaves to King George and decided to mount a rebellion. And out of that, the Declaration of Independence was written. And there's a famous line in the Declaration of Independence that says, "All men are created equal." However, that didn't necessarily apply to us because we were property. And I think this is an important thing you have to remember when you think of people as property. To legitimize that thinking, there was a young black man by the name of Dred Scott. He was owned by a family in Alabama. And they took Dred Scott from Alabama to Missouri and then to Wisconsin. And somehow, during that period, Dred Scott's owner passed away, and he became the property of the wife. And then she would, on occasion, just like any piece of property, she would rent him out. And as it turns out, at one point he lived for a little while as a free man, but he goes back to Missouri, and this woman who owned him decided to sell him. This started, you know, a huge case, the Dred Scott case, because he brought an action against Mr. Sanford, who was the one that owned him, and he sued for his citizenship. Now, this would have been in 1846. This case lasted 11 years, and finally the Supreme Court in 1857 decided Dred Scott, because he was a slave, could not bring an action in federal court. They also ruled that he could not be a citizen, he was property, and therefore his suit had no legal standing. So again, this sets back slaves another 200 years. I was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1947. My father, not educated, maybe fourth grade. His mother was a full Chickasaw Indian woman. And I have just small memories of seeing her. My mother was the product, her father was white. And so she grew up, this little girl with red hair, and they called her Red. And so, you know, I'm a part of that whole mixture, Chickasaw, Indian, white, black, you know. But this was really quite common in the South. During the first week, we talked about your first, what was your first encounter with racism? I was maybe 6 years old, and my mom took me to a five and dime store. And while we were there, it was warm, it was a summer day. I stepped up to a water fountain, and I started to drink. And my mom, she quickly grabbed me by the shoulder, and she pointed out the two signs above. One was marked white, one was marked colored, you know. And she wanted to make sure I drank from the one marked color because she knew what the consequences would have been had I got caught drinking out of the other one. So you take that, and then you combine that with the thought of a person being property. In 1882 until 1968, the practice of lynching still happened in this country. And there was a psychology of lynching, especially in the black community. It was used to pretty much control every aspect of a family's life. When I was in the Army, I was stationed in Europe, and I had a really good friend. I was in my 20s, but he probably was in his late 60s. And his name was, we called him Mr. Applegate. He was a warrant officer. And old Applegate was a heavy, heavy drinker. And one night when he was drinking, he told me a story that he had actually witnessed a lynching once. And when his parents took him. And that's the thing, lynching used to be, in some places, a social event. People would pack their lunch and put on their nice clothes and take their families, and they would witness this. So Applegate tells me about this, and he talked about, he said he never forgot it, because he could not believe that such cruelty could be inflicted on anybody. So you take that, and what you have to understand is, in order to commit those kinds of atrocities, you have to reduce a person to property or something that's subhuman. That is the only way you can do that. So while we think those things don't happen, like I said, lynching, it kind of stopped around 1968. Now, I can remember when I was young, I used to hear whispers about that. And nobody would talk about it, but we used to hear whispers. And I know when my mom stopped me from drinking from that fountain, she was saving my life, because that was a simple act that could have wound me, you know, I could have been, I hate to even think about it. So, you know, you think about all these things, and they form who we are. And then the question becomes, what about reconciliation? How do you do that? And the only way you can have reconciliation is the person who is committing the atrocities have to admit that they've done these things. They got to stand up, like in South Africa, you got to say, we did this, and then you can move on. After the Second World War, the country had committed atrocities against the Japanese, and at some point, the country apologized to the Japanese, paid them reparations. They tried to make those people whole again, which is what they should have done. But to the Chinese who built this country, the railroads, to the African Americans, there has been no such apology, no such attempt at reconciliation. So then the question becomes, where was Christ, you know? And I think about that, where was Christ? We know that he is always with the poor, the less fortunate. And I would imagine that when people were being lynched, he wept with the crowds that were committing these acts. And for the people who were being lynched, he probably said something like, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Then I'll talk a little bit about why I'm here. And I want to end on a real positive note here. You know, I grew up, you know, a Southern Baptist. I was a good Southern Baptist. But that comes with guilt. The Lord is always going to punish you. So, you know, I come here to this church, and the first thing I hear is, man, the Lord loves you. He wants to be in a relationship with you. He wants you to be happy. Well, I feel like 50,000 pounds have been lifted off of me, you know. Yeah, so, and then, you know, and, you know, earlier this week, I ran into Steve and Leslie, and we were talking. And I was telling them how, you know, you guys, this congregation, we are exceptional. And on this corner here in Berkeley, there are great things happening. There are great things that are going to happen. And Ruth and I, we are just so glad to be a part of this and to be a part of this congregation. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your lives and for encouraging us to think about our own journey. I'm not going to do a long introduction to Floyd Tompkins. He is the director of the Center for Innovation. Like, what a cool kind of thing to be, right? To think about innovation at San Francisco Theological Seminary. I think if I'm teasing him, it's a step up from working at Stanford. That's our Berkeley pitch there. But he was formerly the chaplain both at Stanford and also at Princeton. And he's also been an actor. For those of you who know the work of a play called Passages of Martin Luther King, he actually played the key role of Martin Luther King. And as a result of that work, he's been doing also work down at Stanford with the Martin Luther King Center. And he brings a real depth of understanding of King's work, of his own theology, and of his own relationship with Jesus Christ. So please welcome with me Floyd Tompkins. Thank you.
voice, so it may be hard to hear me.
I really am not, actually. Some people know me as like, he really isn't full voice. I've got allergies and been particularly grueling set of travels here lately. But I thank you for letting me. I also want to make an apology because probably about 15 minutes after I having to leave because I'm getting on a plane to go out of town yet again for the next 2 weeks. So I'm really grateful to be here. I want to just, in 20 minutes, he tells me, talk about race in America, talk about religion, get it all done in 20 minutes. What could go wrong? How many ways can you be misheard? How many folks can you make angry? Because that's the problem with race. I need to tell you that even though what in my biography is that I have of, I don't know, the thing keeps in and out. I have been a pastor of a congregation that was all white except for four blacks in Deep South Georgia that went 80% for Trump. I've also been a pastor in an inner city church in San Jose, the second oldest black church west of the Mississippi. And I've also been on campuses in which have multicultural congregation. So race is not something that is foreign to me. In fact, it is something that is implicit in all of these things. And one of the things that happens in a congregation as such is that people look at the notion of race and they say, oh, that's what we shouldn't be worried about. That somehow that it is just simply the, and I know y'all don't say this down here, but at Stanford they say, that's the Berserkly stuff. That's not the real stuff, right? The real stuff is the Bible. The real stuff is the Word. The real stuff is really that kind of stuff. In fact, it's all politics. But then here's the deal, though. The problem is two things. First, is that if you look at from the book of Matthew to the book of Acts, especially, you will notice that the entire gospel is about from the particularity of a Jewish culture into the universality of Gentiles or the world culture. If you look at the last chapter of the book of Matthew, which it does this more than anything, Matthew 8:28-20 says, go into the world and preach to the cosmos. The word there is cosmos, not just, it's the world. I read for many years, I said, preach to the world. Literally, it's like, preach to the widest group of people you can and make sure they're a part of the family. And then Luke, it talks about the idea of what Jesus came for. And so continually, the idea of not inclusion, but expansion. The idea of literally having people be involved in this. Second thing is the notion of race itself. Race is not a real construct. In fact, in the anthropologist, and I'll give you some, afterwards I'm going to give you the articles, right, and stuff like that. Audrey Sambly, actually an anthropologist. The problem is that you read and you only watch Fox News, and you only talk to people who kind of are pseudo-intellectual, right? Then you get a great debate. These things are not even debatable. On an intellectual level, it's not. In fact, I will give you a couple of articles right now because science is arguing that they should not use the word race anymore, not because it's politically incorrect, but that it's just incorrect. That in point of fact, they're trying to silence me, y'all. I'm paranoid for good reason. Okay. So, in point of fact, that race is actually not determinative of anything other. And so what is now in the social sciences and in anthropology is literally race is only a social contract, which means the very term and the very notion itself is in our hands. We can redefine this because we defined it. We can rethink it because it's only a thought. Because the only reality of it, you're like, wait a minute. But you black and I'm white. Now, isn't that a race thing? No, that's a black and white thing. That's not a race thing. Because race is filled with assumptions about the way I act because of the color of my skin. The fact of the matter is that I'm black. You, in fact, that's a problem with policing, right? I have been stopped many times, actually more in California than in Georgia, which was interesting. But more in California, I was stopped. Every time, they did not assume anything. In fact, I'm going to tell you the last time I got stopped was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago in Georgia. I got stopped and a policeman came and I literally made a left turn by a Walmart. A whole lot of other people made that turn. He decided to he decided that he's going to take me and pull me aside, came up, had his hand on his gun, pulled his gun, and I'm thinking, my God. And he just treated me in a very, very harassing way. And I got out. I taught kids, so I survived it. Then I saw him 2 weeks later. Happens to be the church I told you that was all white. The sheriff was one of my congregants. So he sees me the next time 3 weeks later. He goes, hey, how are you? Because now, in that context, I'm cool. That's the problem with race, right? That's why being color is not race. Just by being different is not race. Race is always a defining thing for negativity and control and power. To change that is within our power. Again, I'm going to move very quickly about that and say, so I said that when you say it's a berserkly thing, that I also said, or as Stanford said, it's not intellectually interesting, as in most of the things they do down. Anyway, so, I mean, how interesting is AI? Seriously, I've been thinking for a long time. The machine is just trying to figure it out how. Okay, so the reality is that then we can change this. And so I want to talk to you. I want to read another book I'm going to talk to you about real quickly, because I told you I got to move cool quickly. Is a book that I think everybody should read here. It's a book that is we're involved in a project with the King Center. It's Martin Luther King's last book. Where do we go from here? Chaos or Community? In that he wrote these words: first, the line of progress is never straight. For a period of movement, may follow a straight line, and then it encounters obstacles. And then the path bends. It is like curving around a mountain when you are approaching a city. Often it feels as though you are moving backwards and you lose sight of your goal. But in fact, you're moving ahead, and soon you will see the city again. There are many people that believe that we're moving backwards. Nah, we're just going around a mountain. That in point of fact, the danger of a congregation or anything like that is to look at it and be led by, and excuse me for my terms, by the way, did I tell you that I was ordained in 3 Baptist denominations? That's right. You Presbyterians have got a Baptist here, right? Both in a conservative and a liberal and a non-church, whatever. But point is, so excuse me, I'm going to use one of their constructs because I only have 20 minutes, so it's got to be short time, right? So the problem is when the world leads the church instead of the church leading the world. In fact, I would argue that our definitional reality, and I do this, we have a Center for Innovation and Ministry, the whole thing that I argue, and I love to argue stuff there because I could get in trouble at the Center for Innovation and Ministry. I take only one job my entire life. It's a job that people say, I don't know what you're supposed to be doing. I'm like, I want that job. Because anything I do, I say, that's what you hired me for. And so that's exactly what we're doing right now at the Center for Innovation and Ministry. And one of the things I argue with my partners, and so far we've been pretty good. I'm either a great liar or I'm really teaching them something, which is that our partners are not Kaiser Permanente, Google, and other people. And I've argued that the church, quite frankly, you need us. Y'all looking at me like, yeah, right. Okay, how many of y'all been arguing that we've been post-religious, post-Christian, post-everything, wasn't important, and then Jeff Sexton sat up and stand up the other day and said, the word of God says, we are not post. It is still important, and we're still at the center of things. How dare we take a church and decide to abrogate the power of who we are? We are, now understand this, let me recast some language. You are, in fact, still the light of the world. You're not the light of the world, but we're one of the lights in the world. And one of the things we're trying to do is teach people and be involved in the finding of light in the world. If you're not there, there's some wattage missing. You're one of the salts of the earth. Of course you are. Because as you know, especially in Indian cooking, you miss a couple of spices and the thing tastes totally different. And I'm arguing, and I would argue the church abrogating, leaving it to someone else, thinking that this is the politics. And by the way, I'm going to argue that this bankruptcy, we all know about the bankruptcy on the right, which is evangelicalism. They are really bankrupt. Actually, they're just crazy. I was actually going to say something that involved a bat, but I'm not going to. But they're really crazy, right? They're really crazy. But then we forget that those of you who are progressives, you're crazy too. We are as much of the reason that the present atmosphere is there. See, I didn't mention his name. It's like Voldemort. The present atmosphere is like that now. Because we argued that ethics and morality and values and sense of people weren't important anymore. It was just politics. It was just inclusion. And we walked away. And then we said, well, nobody came to church. Of course they didn't. They didn't know what to come to church for. And then finally, we are also, in both movements, losing spirituality. I know. Let me be old-fashioned here. Prayer matters. Let me tell you something about Martin Luther King. We're involved in a project. Clay Carson, who is the director of the Martin Luther King Papers Program, and I only got 20 minutes, but I'm just telling you right now, that is an enormously important place. It's the only place that Coretta Scott King ever gave permission to study the papers of Martin Luther King. And he could have sat on it, but every piece of scholarship that you read about King had to come and began at Stanford because he's the only one in the world. And instead of a 30-year-old scholar, when he got that, instead of holding it on, he gave it away. But he also now argues at the end of his career that there's one piece that has not been studied about King, which is King as Christian pastor. And quite frankly, that is when you read King, not the books out there, but the papers of King, that is the reason he did everything. It was the reason out of faith that he arose. In fact, I know this is going to shock you. I was surprised by this because I don't even do it. But they said you could not, every single meeting that Martin Luther King had with anybody started with prayer. Now, that's not a conservative, just need to be prayer. But notice the notion of being spirituality improving the very reality of everything I do. Meeting with everyone. I don't care who you are. We're going to pray first. You lose that reality. You will not be able to slay racism because racism is, in point of fact, something that we create. And it's something that we can have to fight. And the demon, if you want to use, again, I know loaded language, don't have time. Basically, the reality of our thought process is bigger than us. And so we have to overturn not only that which is outside of us, but on the inside. I love what was said before. You know, Father looking and saying, what is it in me? What is it in me that I now look and say there's something in me that when I look at it, there was racism there. There was an assumption about a person on the base. Because unless you encounter that, you will not be able to do it. Again, I'll give you this book. Patricia Nell Warren wrote a book and in an essay entitled The Teleology of Racism. Great essay. I just liked the title, quite frankly. I don't know what it meant, but it was great. I liked the title. But she starts off with a story. And it's a story that my brother will know from Mississippi. She was reading, he kind of mentioned it. She was reading a story in the book where she says, this guy, a group of white people have taken this black kid and they stabbed him 49 times. And she began to think, what wouldn't die in him in the 10th time? The 11th, the 20th, the 30th, 49 times. And then she said, because here's the problem. There is something in you that magnifies someone else. They had given that kid supernatural power. It's the reason when I step on an elevator, people always go, I'm like, what? What? Who? What? Okay. I'm a big guy. It's the reason my big guy white friend steps on the elevator. They go, hey, high five. They step on the elevator and they see me and they go, oh, my God, what's he going to do to me? Because in them, I am a supernatural being. I could really hurt them very quickly. Because how twisted is the inside of you? That you look at someone else and you're angry. And you're like, well, but excuse me. I'm sorry. Don't you know the statistics? I know, but I'm not a statistic. In fact, if that statistic, I've got to watch my language here. If that statistic stuff was really true, the most scariest people in the world would be white males going to high school. Ooh, they dangerous. Every time you see them, you would go, oh my God, check them for a weapon. But we don't. So it isn't statistics. It's something deeper and something that has been handed down. And we can overcome it. Because quite frankly, it's not just affecting. It's not just affecting the other people. It's also affecting us. What she argues in an essay is that what she did not understand as a black woman was how painful black, white men and women were. But the problem is, when our pain is acknowledged, theirs is not. Now, she wrote that 20 years ago. Doesn't that sound like something that coming out of the Trump, well, I said his name, something coming out of the analysis of the election? We just didn't understand their pain. And that is absolutely true. That this has to be a pastoral approach. It has to be an approach in which we are looking at not who is the winner. After we make a confession, and my brother also, I love the fact that he referenced the South African thing, right? Because if you don't know that, you think he just said, you confess what you did wrong, and then they gave up. No, the South African Truth Commission was about saying the truth. And you know what happened afterwards? They forgave and move on. The danger is, every time you think that you're saying the truth, I'm going to get beaten up. You might get healed, and together we can now move forward. But you can't move forward without saying the truth. Just yesterday, I talked to somebody. And by the way, this doesn't just work with black stuff. Because the last thing I wanted to say real quickly, because I'm probably about 15 minutes in, you're supposed to tell me when I'm supposed to be there. So are we close? Oh, good Lord. Okay, so thing, there's a lot of quotations I'm not using here. But I'm not going to use the King, whatever. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk to you about is the fact that this isn't about racism. This is about an interconnectivity of evil, which is worse than racism. I was just down at a university that shall not be named, and it was not Stanford. And there was a woman there. And she, you know, I've been there all day. Thank you. I've been there all day. And I was like, I got to go because of traffic. And she's like, I'll have one more conversation. I'm like, dang, I don't have one more conversation. I want to be home. I just got off a plane. But okay. And she looked at me. She said, it's a big deal, me sitting here talking to you. And I thought, oh, God, what's going to happen now? You know, that's never a good thing, you know. And what she was a Presbyterian minister who was a lesbian, who was kicked out of a church, who couldn't be open, who couldn't be ordained, who was an activist. And she said, I haven't been to church in years. And this is a bright, brilliant person. And if I tell you what she's doing, it's amazing. It's what the church needs right now. But because of that brokenness, the church does not have that gift. She is broken. And she says, what do you need? She said, what I need to come back is an apology. The church has not apologized for what they did. She started talking about, I had death threats. And the church has not apologized, and I will not come back. I don't want to see them hurt. I won't say, but there must be an apology. We must come to a point of confession so we can move on. So this is not just a race thing. Be very clear. The interconnectivity, the same evil that excludes one, excludes it all, because the issue is power. And the issue is difference. If you see my black skin as being different, you see some other folk stuff. In fact, you probably see any difference as problematic. I see difference and think, oh, I'm going to have a good meal. No, I see a difference and I go, wow, this is interesting. But you may have been raised to see difference and go, oh, this is dangerous. How? I don't understand what great pain that must be. Because the world is really different in a lot of ways. How much pain are you in that you have, that everything is different, is a threat? So that's why I told you at the beginning, I pastored all white congregation. One of the things is my heart. One of the reasons that I do this work and I get criticized from the left and from the right is because I say to folks, look, this is about justice. But this is also about pastoral care. This is about moving together and empowerment, but it's an empowerment of the whole community. Because I've heard the stories. I've seen the pain. And I know what freedom is. we can just sit with someone and love them for who they are and let them affect who you're becoming. And so I just raised a few issues. One is, what's the pastoral care question about racism? Two is, literally, how do we continue to make it very clear that we as Christians are not peripheral to the conversation, we're central to it. We actually got experience doing this. And three is, and this is the one I'm going to throw in, then you're going to be mad at me, but I got to go for a plane. Can you own the identity of being a Christian and not be a change agent? Can you call yourself Christ-like and let this stuff continue without doing anything? I know it's dangerous. Dude, I pastored the church. Sarah Palin, she came to town. There's only 15,000 people in town. 10,000 came to hear her speak. I kept going, really? Okay. I also pastored the church, which Louis Farrakhan came to town, and every black person that I hadn't seen, I didn't know there were that many black people in the place. I get it. This can be controversial. But can you be a Christian and avoid that? And then finally, how is this calling me to be healed, not to change? See, the language of change is dangerous because it's not full. Because actually, most of the changes that come with ethics and morality and judgment and power weren't changes, they were growth. They were healing. So stop looking at all of this is causing me to change and start looking at what growth is God calling me to. We're doing a project on spirituality and mental illness. And one of the professors said, it is probably more important to answer the questions that come from the darkness than the inspiration of the light. And that is what we're talking about. Don't be scared. Be joyful. It's gonna be fun. It really is. You're gonna have more folk in your life. And the fear may be there, but there's more people walking in it than folk who you think are against you. Or as it was said, there are more people for you than against you. And so I'm going to leave in that 20 minute. If I had full time, I would actually quote a whole lot of people and give you a whole lot more resources. But hopefully you got the gestalt of what I'm saying. Colossians 3:11. Here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, or free, but Christ is all and in all. God bless.
If you don't have a card and want one, Anna's in the back and Mindy on this side, but we would love to receive questions for you. I'm going to ask one question of you, Floyd. It's a softball one, while we collect any questions that are out there. And the questions that don't get asked, we are collecting them, and at the end of the whole entire summer colloquium, we will have a webpage up in the First Press website where they'll have all these questions and all the resources. So. Thank you very much, Floyd, for sharing with us some insights. And one of the ideas that you raised was the importance of the pastoral care. And I'm wondering if you could share a quick anecdote, a story of how pastoral care has come to you such that you've been healed.
Right, absolutely. No problem. When I was 17 years old, I told you about my, I've not talked about white privilege and all this stuff because, quite frankly, you in Berkeley, you hear that all the time. But so the thing that I was 17 years old, I was the lieutenant governor of Key Club, if no, you guys know that. Travel around the state, and my best friend was a Cuban guy, and I am not lying. His name was Fidel Castro, because he... He's coming off if I put it in my hand. I'm not lying. If his name was Fidel Castro, because he Fidel was a hero. And we're out to this party, as 17-year-olds are, in the woods, and we were in northern Florida. If you know North Florida, it is very, to use a colloquial, no, I won't use that colloquial. Let's just put it away. It was very interesting. And a bunch of them came, and they started to, they started to talk about, and I'm going to just use a language. They said, well, I want to tell if you're Southern. I just say spick, nigger, Jew. And I said, oh, my God, we in some serious trouble, aren't we now? I had three friends. I told you I had a Cuban friend, I had a Jewish friend, and me. And so I, being 17 years old, I stand up to them, right? And I looked around, and my two friends were gone. I ran down a car to get out of that. And I'm here today because I'm convinced I would have been lynched or killed. 20 years later, I didn't realize, I used to tell that story and laugh all the time. By the way, when black folks laugh telling a racial story, it's because we have no other response. It's just so crazy. 20 years later, I met a guy who is a politician in the State House of Florida, and I thought, I know you from somewhere. And was the guy who said, spick, nigga, Jew. And he came up to me crying and said, I'm married to a black woman, and I've learned some things about life, and I've prayed that I would meet you, and I apologize to you. I didn't know I needed that apology. I didn't know it was that painful, but it freed me. It also freed me to understand that who somebody might be at 17 is who they might not be at 45, and that I need to not assume that they stood still in time. And so, you know, I do watch that politician's career and make sure he votes right, because if he don't, you know, I'm going to write him a little note.
Let's try switching mics and see if that helps us out.
You
can turn that one off. Here's another question for you. It's often a challenge for those of us in the church to engage in confession about racism, because we see ourselves as individuals who are not culpable because we don't use the N-word. How would you go about doing that pastoral work to encourage us as a congregation to think more broadly, more deeply?
Okay, first of all, I didn't ask you to confess about racism in general, but about how it affects in this context. One of the things is, I'm asking you, some people hear me talk and they go, wow, boy, that's a lot easier. No, actually, I'm asking you to do something much harder, which is to look into one's own biography, and had nothing to do with the word in. I mean, if you use the word in, yeah, big time, you need it, right? But there's some other stuff you need to do, right? I mean, for example, I used to challenge folk all the time and say, why is it, and this is not true in this congregation, if it is, I didn't know it, so, you know, take it for what it was. I used to say, how many folks here work in a job where it has at least five black folks, and everybody raised their hand, and blah, blah, blah. And then I say, how many folk are in this church? Zero. You think that's accidental? Because usually if you like a place you invite people to, your form of racism, you don't even invite black folks here because it's not a black church. Who told you that we only go to black churches? That's the assumption of racism. And in different ways you start looking at that, and that's what the confession is about. It's not about, because then we'll get to systemic. I guarantee you. But the first you've got to begin with the personal ways. And that's one of the easiest things. Again, not this congregation, probably not true. But is your church at least, and then think, what's the last time you invited somebody of color to your church? Well, oh, they got their own churches. Well, it didn't bother you with the other white person that's down there. And by the way, let me just tell you right now, people don't know this. The seven major historical black churches was not born because we wanted to segregate. Every one of those churches historically came to be because they were kicked out of the church. They were literally, so nobody, it wasn't like, well, we black folk wanted the church. No, Richard Allen was praying. He was kicked out. Southern Baptists said, you can't have black folk in Negro heaven. They were kicked out. That's how the church came to be. Then after a while, they found out there are certain strengths in that, and that's how it born. But it isn't that black folks said, I don't want to be a part of an integrated congregation. They could not be a part of an integrated congregation. I just gave that one for free. So the notion, so that's one of the different ways is to think, you know what, I really haven't. I don't invite people. I invite them on the basis of race. Think about that. That's one of the ways you confess. So the idea is there are people that do this. You come in and you take your own personal biography, both black and white. And that's what you confess. Then after you do that, I guarantee you it is easier to see the systemic stuff. Because you realize a whole bunch of people like yourself who think they're doing nothing are doing a whole lot, and it leads to that. Because that's what it means. It doesn't mean that everybody's intentionally trying to hurt everybody. But the danger of what's inside is killing people. Maybe Jeff Sessions is, I don't know, maybe so. See, I won't mention Voldemort, but I will mention Jeff. Go ahead.
So this next one is about change or healing. It seems like, in part, you're talking about how our culture, the culture of the church, needs to be healed.
Right.
But feels like perhaps it's under threat from other cultures.
How so?
Immigrant cultures, gay culture.
How is that a threat?
That's the question.
Okay.
How do you help us not see that as a threat, but actually...
Sure. Sure, absolutely. This is so wonderful. That question comes all the time, and so it's a little bit of a theatric thing. How is that a threat? Okay. First of all, I told someone, where's the guy that, anyway, I don't say him anyway. There's a documentary that's coming out that's going to look at the churches that were, that wrote to Martin Luther King and told him to wait, what, 45 years ago? Almost every single one of them is dead or dying. The people who left those churches and started churching, they're thriving. Let me be very clear. Not only is it not a threat, it's a blessing that you ain't letting in. So let's be very clear. You will die if you don't change. And that is not, that is a spiritual, that is a philosophical, that is a biological reality. Adaptation is how who wins in evolution. Adaptation is how who wins everywhere else. So, That's my hard edge. Now I'm going to be nice and smile a lot. Not only is it not a threat, but the reality is the people who want to join you are not only, it's not like every black person want to join your church. In fact, there's a whole lot of people that burn the mother down. Those people don't come in here. You won't have to worry about that. That ain't the kind of people that want to come to church. The kind of people that want to come to church are people who believe God and say, let's work this thing out together. The kind of gay, I mean, there's a whole, in fact, in the number one growing group of people joining churches now, which is shocking to me somewhat, is gay and lesbians. It's not, they're not a threat. But if they're going to come, there's an organization called Glitter. They're going to take the liturgy and they want to glitter it up a little bit. Not my words, their words, right? And I just came back from Atlanta, Georgia, and the center is actually going to be doing and we were invited in because we're doing a catalyst with black churches and transgender people. Because quite frankly, they want to join the church too. And they're already in the church, it's just that now they're closeted. So the notion that somehow these folks are a threat is one not really giving them their humanity. Look who's trying to join you. I mean, just personally. I'm not talking about Theo. Just personally. Secondly, if they don't join you, and if you can't be relevant, Jesus left the last thing. This is where I'm going to be evangelical here now. All right? Remember he said, come, go into the cosmos. Relevancy is how faith grows. If you don't pass the test of relevancy, and if every single generation, I'm about to say this to GA and they're going to get mad at me, but I'm about to say to you, look, if you're not relevant, people should not come to your church. Because it's time. It's the proposition that every single person who's trying to sell anything in the world is doing. They're making a value proposition. And I believe that faith is a good value. And I believe that we respond to your questions and your problem. And I believe that your life will live better in relationship with God than without. And I believe that for everybody. And if you can't make that faith proposition is only for some people, then quite frankly, the church is going to die. And it should, but good news, something else will come. You either want to be the dying or the trying part. Because sometimes, like Martin Luther King, they look the same, but they end up very different. So it is not a threat. And again, I do not want you to think about change. Throw that change word out. Change is a dangerous word. Change is a dangerous word financially, because nobody wants change. They want dollars. And change is a bad word philosophically, because it always means losing something. Think of it as healing. Think of it as relevancy. When you put that on there, how can you not want to be whole and relevant? But wait a minute, they're going to come in here and they're going to talk about making us whole and relevant. By the way, also the center is doing a 6-hour training with executive presbyteries, all 187 of them, on transgender issues. They ask us to do it because we're very good at this training stuff. But the point is, they understand. We don't know what to do. And you have to create an environment where, and that's what they wanted, and I do this, and I'll fight anybody, an environment where your questions aren't indictments. They're just really questions. It's okay. Last story, oh, it's the funniest thing in the world. It's not funny, but what's funny? Michael Ady, who used to be the head of More Light for 20 years, he and I went to down to Charlottesville. By the way, the transgender workshop, going to be in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's a story in and of itself. Okay. You just never know what's going to happen. Okay, so we're sitting there with a chaplain, and he's literally, and I can't do this without doing it in an accent, and you understand. He's like, I just don't know what to call him. He said, should I call him a he or she? Should I say an it? I don't know. And I told Michael, we can't say anything. We just got to let him talk, right? We both walked out there and go, it did not occur to him he could just ask. But it didn't. It didn't. He wasn't, and this is the guy who said, I want to know. He wasn't being just a mean-spirited whatever. Do not assume that it's about healing. When you realize that and someone stands up and says that kind of junk, you can go, boy, that's a hurt. Ooh, Lord, that's a car accident right there, wasn't it? Okay, how can we do it? The only issue is finding, also keeping safe space for those. That's the issue we're raising in now. But you've got to be able to look at people who sometimes look like vilely racist, and you get in the back of that thing and you went, wow, somebody really hurt you. You really, and then the reality, because good Lord, I know people who don't watch anything other than Fox News. If you watch only Fox News, I guarantee you have a different understanding of reality, right? I watch Fox, I watch CNN, NBC, I watch them all three, but if you only watch that one thing, you can understand that. I don't know, I can't tell you how crazy some of the myths are out there. And I understand your pain.
Unfortunately, we're at the end of our time, so I'm just going to pray for Floyd and close our time. We will continue to collect the questions, as I told you earlier, and we'll put them up on the website. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you for our brother, Floyd, for his words of encouragement and challenge, for helping us to even change our own language and the ways that we think about change to that of healing. May that even be part of our healing this morning, O Lord. As we go forth to worship, to go into your community, to be your servants, we thank you also for Ruth and Vent and for their words to us, their encouragement and challenge. Thank you, O Lord, that they are part of this congregation, that they, along with Leah and the others who shared on the first panel, that we can continue to be in the presence of brothers and sisters who can share from their own lives what it means to be your faithful disciples. Lord, healing is what we need. So as we share in a meal, as we share in worship, as we share in living our faith out in the world, heal us as we are your servants of healing in the world. We pray this in your son's name. Amen. Thank you very much for coming. I just want to remind you, we need to move some of the chairs out of the way, bring in the tables as quickly as possible to set up for the table, but I thank you for coming. We'll see you next week when it'll be Mary Ellen Azada who will join us and Paul Yeager. Thank you.